The wall is out at the West Wyandotte Library in Wyandotte County in Kansas City, Kansas. It will be out there all this month of March, the Women's History Month. And I was reminded that I hadn't told people how big it is. It's a 10-panel photo montage. It's 24 feet in length, and I should be able to have some pictures of it up on your webpage pretty soon and up on the Greater Kansas City Women's Equality webpage. And just to say what it is, it's a photo montage that chronicles women's journey since winning the vote in 1920. I think, are we ready for the news now?
We're ready.
Okay.
We are ready.
All right.
Okay, here we go with the news today. Thanks for your patience. A Texas woman has developed booby trap bras after she was nearly mugged by a man while running. Jennifer Cutrona, 35, told the Houston Chronicle her just-in-case bra can hold a small knife or a pepper spray canister. The items can be held in a slit in the front of the bra. I wanted to be able to carry a knife on me in a practical way, she told the Chronicle. When I put it on, I felt that confidence come back. She continued, I wanted to be for women to just have a practical way to carry whatever they're comfortable carrying. Cutrona's bras are currently under a provisional patent, but she is working to develop a full patent. The provisional patent gives me a year to test my market, and I believe the market is responding in an incredible way, she told the Chronicle. She said the goal of the bras is to empower women in case they are face-to-face with a potential threat. I'm not trying to turn women into fighters. Nobody wants to think about it. But in the situation where you have to protect yourself, it's a life-or-death scenario, Cutrona told the Chronicle. Then you have it in the most practical place in that worst-case scenario. The bras range in sizes from small to XXL and cost anywhere from $49 to $55, CBS 7 reported March 17th. In a press release statement on March 15th, the International Center for Research on Women, ICRW, welcomed the launch of the long-awaited U.S. strategy for adolescent girls, launched by Secretary of State John Kerry in Washington, D.C. ICRW, in conjunction with Girls Not Brides USA, has been leading a coalition of civil society organizations that has been urging the Obama administration to create such a strategy and contributed to the content of the strategy. The United States is the first country to pen a strategy solely focused on the protection and advancement of adolescent girls. The strategy contains five major objectives. Enhance girls' access to quality education in safe environments. Provide economic opportunities and incentives for girls and their families. Empower girls with services, skills, information, and support. Mobilize and educate families and communities to end harmful practices like female genital mutilation / cutting and strengthen policy and legal frameworks and accountability. Now the United States truly leads the world in recognizing that adolescent girls face the unique challenge of a double burden as both youth and females, yet are uniquely positioned to increase socioeconomic development outcomes, said ICRW Senior Policy Manager Lyric Thompson. After all, research tells us that when given the opportunity to stay in school, access health information and services, and learn to assert their rights to live free of violence and discrimination, entire communities, and indeed countries, benefit socially and economically. The five objectives of the strategy are based on key approaches that emerged from a systematic review of the evidence to end child, early, and forced marriage, uncovered and documented by the International Center for Research on Women.
Thank you, Ebony. And thank you, Craig, for engineering for us today. And Amy, are you going to join in this conversation with us over here? Are you going to sit over there? She's going to stand right here. Okay. Jane McLean is our guest, and we're going to talk today. Tell us what we're going to do today, Jane.
Okay. Well, today we're going to look at some of the women who, American women, and there really aren't that very many of them, who have run for President of the United States outside the time frame of the wall. The first woman in America to run for president was Virginia Woodhull, who did it in 1872. She did run on a third party, and she ran just at the time that there was a question of whether the 14th and 15th Amendments had actually given women the right to vote. It turned out that our Missouri friend Virginia Minor, who tried to vote and took her suit to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that deciding who was a citizen and who had the right to vote was a state's rights. And so it's going to be 1920 before women have the right to vote. And that due to an amendment to the Constitution. And that's where the Wall of Women's Achievement starts. Well, it wasn't until 1964 that an American woman ran for President of the United Nations, or for, she didn't run for president, she ran for the nomination. And her name was Margaret Chase Smith. Now, I don't suppose that the name of Margaret Chase Smith is a household term. Probably if you know anything about her, because you've studied history or you paid a good attention in your American history class, was that she was the first woman to speak out against Joe McCarthy in his campaign against communists in the State Department. But before that, she was the first woman elected on her own right to the Senate in the United States. Before that, she had come into the House of Representatives at the death of her husband in 1940. So by 1964, she had 24 years of experience in the House of Representatives, and then she went to the Senate in 1950. Well, she and Joe McCarthy were both on the same Senate committees, the Senate for Permanent Investigations. And she was really tough. She was a cold warrior, and she thought Truman was a little bit weak on the Soviets, and she wasn't really against McCarthy at the first, but as he went along, she began to worry about the virulence of his attacks. And she asked him, well, now, if all these people in the State Department are communists, surely you have some evidence. Well, she waited and she waited, and she didn't get any evidence. And she finally realized that there wasn't any evidence, or she was never going to get any. So she made a speech in 1950 in the Senate. It's called the Declaration of Conscience speech. And she speaks as a Republican. And she said, I speak as a woman. I speak as a Republican. I speak as a U.S. Senator. And I speak as an American. She says, those of us who shout the loudest about Americanism in making character assassinations are all too frequently those who, by our own words and acts, ignore some of the basic principles of Americanism, like the right to criticize, the right to uphold unpopular beliefs, the right to protest, the right to independent thought. The exercise of these rights should not cost one single American citizen his reputation or his right as a livelihood. She went on to attest that she did feel the present Truman administration was ineffective, Democratic administration. But at the end, she warned her fellow Republicans, "I don't want to see the Republican Party ride to political victory on the four horsemen of calumny, fear, ignorance, bigotry, and smear. Surely we Republicans aren't that desperate for victory." And her speech was widely reported to the national press, often with only praise and invariable noting her single statue as the Senate's only woman.
I'm just so excited about this woman.
She was amazing.
Well, what really excites me is that this really points to the need to celebrate conservative women too, because they're the one who are going to say, "Wait a minute, you all are off the wall now. Bring it back. Let's talk about fiscal policy and stuff like this." And, you know, well, she was talking about keeping a better eye on the Russians, but, you know, she was the one that stood up and said, "Hey, no, this is too much. Let's bring it back." You know, where are the women right now, these conservative women? You know, a lot of them we still don't maybe agree with on this show, but they play a really important role. And this is a really great example of how conservative women are a very important part of this feminist experience and bringing women's perspectives to what may be the other side of the aisle for a lot of people who listen to the show.
Yes, and she was known as being an independent thinker. She represented Maine, and she had worked as, after her husband's death. She didn't remarry, so she was a single woman for the rest of her life. And it's interesting that she never saw herself or talked about being a feminist, but she, and you find this is about the same for many of the women in Congress, although during World War II she was on the Naval Committee and she worked for women in the Navy. She was just an upright person and is known in the annals of congressional history as one of the outstanding. In fact, she was in Congress from 1940 through 1973. So she really made a difference. And yes, she was really, I think at that time, had come very much out of what it meant to be American, was very patriotic, had gone through World War II. And one of the responses, Bernard Baruch, who was an advisor to presidents in that era, said, "Had a man delivered Smith's Declaration of Conscience speech, he would be the next president of the United States."
I was going to just ask that. So this woman is obviously very qualified. A lot of times when we talk about the first women to do something, we think of that being the thing that they did, the thing that they were the first at. But this is really important that, well, why did they have the right to be the first at that?
Exactly.
What did they do? What did they work towards? How did they get there? And what happened to her when she ran? Was this...
Okay, I'm glad you asked.
Funny to people, I bet.
But I should add that McCarthy did retaliate, and he removed her from the subcommittee, the permanent investigations, and he replaced her by a new senator, Richard Nixon.
Well, McCarthy didn't last much longer than that either, though. So.
No, but long enough to cause an awful lot of
trouble. Yes, 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 but he... Mm-hmm. His career did not end as illustriously, is all I'm saying.
No, he didn't. It's interesting. Margaret Chase Smith decided to run for the presidency in the summer of 1963. And there were murmurings about it. And the fact that she was the first to really push for with a major party. And very poignantly, really, President John Kennedy's last press conference just a week before his trip to Dallas, He fielded a question about the upcoming 1964 presidential race and was, could you comment on the possible candidacy of Margaret Chase Smith? Now, just the fact that that question was there provoked merriment among the mostly male press corps. But JFK responded seriously. He said, and I can't do a Boston accent, but he said, I think she's very formidable, if that is the appropriate word to use for a very fine lady. She is a very formidable political figure, and anyone running against her should take her seriously. She held off her decision after Kennedy's assassination until January, and she kept people guessing whether she was going to run or not. In fact, even her speechwriter didn't know, so he prepared two endings to her announcement. And she made her announcement at the Women's National Press Club. There was a Men's National Press Club and a Women's National Press Club at the time. And so she talked about the many reasons not to run. Well, there are those that make the contention that no woman should ever dare to aspire to the White House, that this is a man's world and that it should be kept that way. Some say women don't have the stamina. And goodness, there would be humiliation, the crushing defeat. They're going to have lack of professional campaign support and support and financial resources. And then she thought, well, she has her cherished roll call record. She was almost compulsive obsessive about making every vote, every roll call vote. And she thought, well, if I ran, I wouldn't, you know, I'd be derelict in my congressional duties. She said, but because of these reasons not to run, they were very impelling. And because they were so impelling, she would run. So the women cheered. And that her run would be a test just to see if it could be done. How much support could she garner without campaign funds? Her expenses would be limited to personal travel costs paid by the candidate. She'd be without professional party organization. And she would refuse to absent herself from her Senate duties. And she would not purchase political time on TV or radio. Now, these sound absurd. They had served her well in her campaigns in Maine and it's going to be a real test because this is 1964. Television, radio is coming up. And she would run on her record. She would make no campaign promises. Well, you know, it's just a question. Is she being absolutely naive? Well,
I think a little naivete is necessary, you know, in some regards. Even if you think about a person being an entrepreneur, you have to have some sort of idea that, oh, maybe I can do this. And you hear so many people later say how absurd they may have thought it was at the time or didn't, and other people did and decided to do something anyway. Because even what you have said, it rings true today. It's as if it's as if this information could be reported on the news right now, you know, as far as our current politics are going on.
I was really struck when I started working on this of how much it resonated in our own situation today. But you ask about what happened.
Well, I also want to say that taking these risks and having the naivete is important for breaking new ground sometimes. But also I think maybe politically she protected herself. If she said she was going to go full boat and collect a whole bunch of donations and then didn't get any, what would that have said about women running for president? It might have set us back a lot longer had she said she was going to be a traditional serious candidate and been left with empty coffers.
That's true. And when you asked about her reception, I think her media coverage also helps us somewhat resonates today. It's not quite like this, but the day after her announcement, the New York Times wrote, Mrs. Smith, a trim woman with snow-white hair, wore a black suit and brown alligator heels. Her only accessories were two strands of pearls and a yellow rose pinned to her lapel. No word about her 24 years in Congress, et cetera, et cetera. And then the media constantly mentioned her age. At 66, she is an exceedingly attractive figure, slender, silver-haired. She is regarded as being beyond, she is regarded as being beyond the optimum years for presidency. Smith responded, says, since my candidacy was announced, almost every news story starts off, the 66-year-old senator. I haven't seen age played up in the case of the male candidates.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes back to what I said earlier, where you don't really seem to hear about what got the first woman to that place.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be exactly why you never find out why this was the first woman.
Mm-hmm.
Why was this the first woman who ran for president? Well, because she had a long career in politics that was very illustrious and was a very formidable woman, according to, was it JFK?
Well, yes.
And she was incredibly qualified. And the things, the comments that she made about no campaign funding and We would just die to hear a candidate say that today. Mm-hmm. It would be refreshing.
It also occurred to me that were it not for Bernie running, we might be hearing more about Hillary's age. Because it just flashed me back to how old is Hillary? Oh, she's a whatever-year-old grandmother. And then Bernie steps out there, and he's a however-year-old man, 74 or whatever, I'm not sure. So that's probably worked to Hillary's advantage.
Right, and primaries were just coming in at that time. But anyway, she did run in three primaries in New Hampshire, Oregon, and Illinois. And she's running against Barry Goldwater and Henry Cabot Lodge. She got 3,000 votes in New Hampshire to Henry Cabot Lodge's 30,000. She really did not have a lot of time on the road, and she was spending her own expense money to get there, and she was keeping up her duties. She also campaigned in Oregon and Illinois. And in Illinois, she did come in second to Goldwater with nearly 30% of the vote. And that's the best she got. But she did hang in there until the July Republican National Convention. And at that point, she was the first woman who had her – she listened and heard her name – get placed in nomination for the presidency. And even though she went in with only about a handful of delegates, maybe about 25, 30 delegates, she refused to turn them over to Goldwater so that he did not get a unanimous nomination on the first round. But a woman reporter wrote a day later, she was able to do, Margaret Chase Smith, was able to do what no other woman has since this country began, be formally nominated at the national convention of a major party for the office of president. Mm. And, oh, they also did mention that she came to the convention in a dark red dress with an ivory rose.
Nice.
I'm sure she looked lovely.
I'm sure she
with her silver white hair.
And her slender, very attractive, very attractive for a 66-year-old.
I wonder where those alligator shoes were.
I don't know. I guess they didn't see what she was wearing. But she didn't. She missed her pearls. No pearls that day.
Well, we're going to take a quick station break and then come back with more stories of women running for the White House.
Celebrate Women's History Month with the women leaders of Stand Up KC, who are leading the fight for 15 and union rights for low-wage workers. Join them Thursday, March 24th, for a free screening of the film Standing on My Sister's Shoulders and a guest speaker at the Tivoli Theater. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. Film starts at 7. Following the film, hear from special out-of-town guest Rosalind Pellis. Please RSVP by emailing info@standupkc.org. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
On the next Radioactive Magazine, Dr. Nathan Madden, Ph.D. in Political Science, and Radioactive Magazine host Brian Nolan discuss Cooling the Burn, Bernie Sanders' Big Problems. They will also provide an election update after Hillary Clinton's and Donald Trump's upset victories on March 15th. Tune in, Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday, 6 p.m.
This is Every Woman. We're back with Jane McLean. And who's our next woman candidate for president?
9 years later, we have Shirley Chisholm. Now, Shirley Chisholm is different and the same. So let's go at it. Shirley Chisholm was the first woman first woman and the first African to seek the nomination in the Democratic Party for the presidency. She did that in the 1972 election. Now, she did not have the vast legislative experience. She was born of immigrant parents in Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn. And her parents, I think, significantly were from Barbados. And she had been sent to back there to live for a while when she was a young child. So she had come from a place where there was the experience of having strong black leadership. She started out in early childhood education. By the time she was elected to the United States House of Representatives in 1968, she had served for 4 years in the New York Assembly. And so she did have legislative experience. Interestingly, she did not sit around and wait to pay her dues in the United States House of Representatives.
That sounds like another first African-American presidential name that we had at the moment.
Yes, and she had come up through, she had battled the remnants of the Democratic boss in her district, and she had fought for re-election on unbossed and unbought. So when she got to Congress, she deliberately hired a staff of young women, half of whom were black, for her office positions, not just the lower-level ones that are usually occupied by women. And she had no intention of sitting and observing. She said, "I intend to speak out immediately in order to focus on the nation's problems." And her first floor speech was against the Vietnam War, in which she vowed against voting for any new military spending. Now, interesting, she also rebelled. She was assigned to the Agriculture Committee and the Rural Development and Forestry Subcommittee. She said, "I can't imagine why they put me from Brooklyn they must have heard something like a tree grew in Brooklyn. she complained. And she complained to the supervisor. They said, you know, you have to buckle down. You have to pay your dues. And she said, I came here to help the people. And the black and the urban poor. And she did get change from the Agriculture Committee to the Veterans Affairs Committee. She said, well, there are a lot more veterans and trees in my district, so we'll go with that.
That's kind of surprising because it seems to me like the agricultural states would have a big problem with a Brooklyn rep on the agricultural committee. Like, of course she had a problem with it, but it's shocking to me that the agricultural states didn't have a big problem with that.
Well, they probably didn't know much about it, or the people that were on there. I think they just tried to tuck her away in a corner someplace and let her mold. No.
Yeah.
So she went on, and during her tenure, she was a founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus, and then a few months later, the Congressional Women's Caucus. You have to. What's going on right now is that women are coming to the fore. Blacks are emerging. It's really a tumultuous time. Roe versus Wade, 1972. People are swirling around, and it's a time. She was also a founding member of the National Women's Political Caucus, along with people like Bella Abzug, Betty Friedan, and Gloria Steinem. In fact, I have a picture of the four of them on the wall with the founding of the National Women's Political Caucus. Well, you asked Amy before of how did these women come to this idea of running for president. She didn't start with that idea. In fact, part of her, during her first year, she went out and she spoke at over 40 campuses. Mm. And invariably at the end, someone would say, are you thinking about running for president in 1972? And she would say, well, you know, my qualifications or not, I'm black and I'm a woman. So finally at one of them, a white young man got up and said, well, when are we going to break this tradition? And she said that thought stuck in her mind, and her answer was, never, if not now. Mm-hmm. And so the idea to run built over, you know, a 2-3 year period.
Well, that's really amazing because that's the kind of political leaders that we ideally want, the ones who are willing to sacrifice themselves mm-hmm. for the public good. And it was a sacrifice because she knew she was going nowhere. She knew that she was just putting herself up to be ridiculed, to be kind of made into a sideshow, but she did it so that someday someone else could break those molds. She knew it wasn't going to be her.
I think she did, but she would never admit it during the campaign.
Well, that would have been bad, sure.
And people did ask her. Well, 1972, there were 12 other people running in the race against her on the Democratic ticket. In fact, there was another woman, and you'll recognize her name, Patsy Takamoto Meek, was talked into running. She ran in one primary in Oregon and then dropped out after a poor showing. But there was in the wind for a woman to run. She was running against George McGovern, Herbert Humphrey, George Wallace, and 12 others. Her announcement speech is worth listening to you. I stand before you today to repudiate the ridiculous notion that the American people will not vote for qualified candidates simply because he is not white or because she is not male. I do not believe that in 1972, the great majority of Americans will continue to harbor such narrow and petty prejudice. Well,
we've run out of time.
I hope we get to do this some more.
But tell us one more time where the Wall of Women's Achievement is.
Okay. It's at the West Wyandotte Library, and it will be there in Kansas City, Kansas. It's on 82nd Street between State and Parallel.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
But we didn't get to hear about Geraldine Ferraro.
Well, we were going to have to bring her in next week then.
Oh, I guess so. Will that work? Do we have a show next week that's full up, or can we squeeze in a... We can
squeeze in a presidential candidate, but we have to take a station break right now. Thank you for joining us.
Peace. Stay tuned.
This week...
Is it chauvinism or is it equality? Is it ethnocentricity or is it pluralism and equality? These are the values I believe are Jewish values.
What happens when religious beliefs clash with women's rights in Israel? On buses, on sidewalks, and in the skies. I'm Maureen Fiedler. That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right after your Fusion Funkmeister.
Mom on a Mission will sponsor Walk a Mile in My Shoes on April 2nd, 2016 at 9 a.m. Central Park, 31st Indiana. You can register online at mamaonamissioninc.com. That's M-O-M-M-A on a missioninc.com. Registration by March 19th, 2016.
This message is a public service of 90.1 FM KKFI.
Hi, this is Michael with Flexin' KC. Thanks for joining us today on Every Woman. This is KKFI 90.1 FM here in Kansas City, Missouri. Today we have in our studio Barbara Washington. Barbara is a lawyer slash entrepreneur who passionately believes in giving back to her community. In fact, she has positioned herself as an advocate for young women and particularly young men in the Kansas City court system with her law firm, Washington Law, LLC, located at 4609 The Paseo here in KCMO. She truly believes that a village helped to raise her and led her to what she is doing today. Barbara has a message to mothers, sons, daughters, parents. Specifically, support your young black men. Let's listen to what she has to say.
As our closing question, or actually statement, I want you to say something to parents and students. Parents, to help those children who may get into a little trouble, to know that you shouldn't judge them for what they're in. And then for those students to know what they should do to go forward, even if they do get in a little trouble.
For the parents, the first thing I want to say is, God bless my mother. If not for my mother, I wouldn't be standing here today. I wouldn't have graduated from college. I wouldn't have gone to law school. If you don't support your kids when they get in trouble, especially our boys, then you are giving them to the police that's taking their lives. And this message is specifically, I'm sorry, Bishop Tolbert, for the mothers. He's a man, and you got to make sure he's a man, and you can't baby him. So one of the things that for us as African-American attorneys, which is disheartening, is you come to us, you know he has done wrong, but you don't want to accept it. And that doesn't help him, because that also gives him over to the man that ends up taking his life. For the kids, stop hustling, stop doing the wrong thing, go to school. Because you're not going to see anybody that's making a lot of money, which is what you want to do, or having a lot of respect, that didn't go to school. I can't stress enough to finish school. I think that would be the best thing I could say.
Thank you. Thank you, Barbara. Give her a round of applause.
Yeah, and thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity. My full name is Barbara Ann Washington. I've been practicing law for almost 20 years, all here in Kansas City. So I represent mostly people in the African-American community. I do criminal defense. I do personal injury matters. And I do anything that's at municipal court. And I also do a lot of business consulting. I kind of do that pro bono. I haven't figured out how to make people pay me for my advice yet, but we'll work on that.
Barbara, I wanted to invite you here because I've seen you in different venues, from the Urban Summit to even UN Women in Kansas City, as well as some of the other workshops around town. Why are you so involved in what's going on in Kansas City right now?
This morning I was at a meeting, an Urban Summit education meeting, and the term Talented 10th came up. And while I don't feel I'm part of the Talented 10th, the whole premise behind that is the Talented 10th of those of us that are African Americans will reach back and help those others that are behind us. I grew up in a family that's really truly lives by the adage, to whom much is given, much is required. So I feel like God's given me the opportunity to overcome some obstacles, to go on to college, to go on to law school, and coming from the inner city, everybody doesn't do that. I just feel it's my duty to make sure that I'm involved in my community, to try to help keep my community abreast of what's going on and uplift my community as best as I can.
How do you think other African Americans are doing in that realm? Do you think that we're stepping up to, you know, our responsibilities, or do you think there's more we can do?
I think there's always more that can be done. I also think that my age group, I'm 48, and it seems to be like that 38 to 55 people, we may have missed the boat a little bit. I think we had the civil rights right before, you know, when I was a baby and all that came through, and then we got a little complacent. So I'm really proud and respectful of those who are the generation behind me, those that are 37 and under, especially at my university at Mizzou. The 1951 kids who stepped up and spoke up for the racial discrimination that goes on there. So I think that there's they have a lot of work to do, because we got really complacent. We got the good jobs. We got in college. We got to move out to the suburbs. And some of that made us forget about those we left behind, and made us forget that we too are black and we still have issues and things that we need to fight for.
You know, I agree with you. So there has been some complacency, and the way that it shows itself is a type of silent revolutionary. You know, everybody's a revolutionary at home in front of their television set.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah.
But when it comes to, you know, the things that actually make a difference, those things aren't the things that people are so involved in. I've realized that, okay, it's great to be able to watch the issues and be able to talk about the issues, but I wanted to be able to be involved in changing some of those issues or impacting the issues. And that really takes you being involved in the community and not just your television set.
That's correct. You mentioned some of the things that I do. I do go to Urban Summit and I try to help out. I'm on a couple of committees there. And with the United Nations, what kind of propelled me into getting involved is, internationally, our sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated, has developed a four-year partnership with the United Nations that we hope will continue to grow after 2018. So that was my initial impetus. But what really got me to be involved in do some programs for United Nations, some informative programs, and I'm now on the local board, was I went on vacation to Dominican Republic, and the issue with the Haitians and putting the Haitians out. It really bothered me to see brown people versus black people. And I just wanted attention for us as African Americans in America to understand what's going on with our people around the world and what we could do to help them. And the United Nations, for me, was the best way to do that. With the Urban Summit, I think you have a lot of our old school people who are still fighters in our community. And what better way to learn to how to fight the best way in this community than to learn from those who've been doing it for decades and decades.
So that brings us to how does the Urban Summit work? The Urban Summit has different cells in it, or different committees. What are the committees that you're involved in?
I am primarily involved with the education cell, or the education committee, which addresses issues as to how we can better serve our children in the Kansas City community, primarily the school districts that have African-American students, which right now are mostly Kansas City, Missouri, and in Mills. And as a result of that, I decided to run for office for the MCC, or Metropolitan Community Colleges Board of Trustees, because I see that as an extension of our children in school. I mean, if they're not, a lot of times they're not being prepared on the high school level, so they can't get on to the four-year schools, and they end up at MCC, whether that's Pioneer, well, I'm sorry, they don't have Pioneer anymore, whether that's Penn Valley or Longview, or even some of them at Blue River now, because we've moved out east a little bit. And I decided to run because I want to make sure that those kids don't get lost, because they got lost in high school, and we need to bring them back into the fold to make sure that they are properly prepared to be citizens of our society.
Well, how do you see that children will be properly prepared? What are some of the things that you think helps to identify them as they're prepared? We know that they can handle themselves.
Basically, right now in our school district, a lot of kids can't even do the basics. And when you grow up, you're supposed to be able to do the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. And they're not there. We have too many kids that are graduating from high school that are not there, to the point that one of the great things I do appreciate about the MCC system is they have classes that fill up that gap, so that there is a what they call a math 20, so that you didn't get the basic math so that you can move into college algebra in high school. So we're going to get you these few classes to get you to where a regular college student should be. And so I think we have to work with them on that. Let's identify the deficiencies. Let's help with the deficiencies. And this is system-wide, both in the public school system, secondary school, and in the junior college and collegiate system. Let's identify what these issues are, and let's address them and come up with some programs so that we can get our schools and our kids back to where we were 50 years ago.
Do you see that the neighborhoods will have anything to say about what happens in the schools, as far as the neighborhoods that have been impacted by such blight? Do you see that bringing in more people into these homes will be able to help the situation with the school attendance at all?
I would hope so, because, you know, right now the Kansas City School District has less than 15,000 kids. A lot of it is because half of the eligible students are going to charters. A lot of it is dropout. But a big part of it is desegregation and black flight, where folks are moving to, they've moved on to Raytown and Grandview and even Hickman Mills. When I was in high school, that wasn't a black district. It is now. And they've moved even as far as Belton and Raymore and Johnson County, and all of those places have good school systems. But when you do that, then you leave the core of your city empty, and you leave a situation like what's happened to Kansas City School District, where it's unaccredited, it's still working and continuing to struggle to bring itself back to greatness. I'm a product of that school system. My sister and brothers are, my child, my nephew, and we all went to college. So I know that the system can work. We just have to work to make it. But you do have to, I don't think just because we have a vacant house next door is the total answer. Mm-hmm. But I do think bringing people back in will revive our community, because but you got to give them a good program, because I'm not going to put my kid in a school just because I moved down here to buy a house for a dollar. Doesn't mean I'm going to put my kid in a bad school. I still want my kids to go to a good school. Mm-hmm. So it also depends on who's buying the homes. If there's a lot of investors, then a lot may not actually change. So we want to have people that are buying the homes, coming back into the community and making a real impact.
Well, one of the stipulations that the land bank is having on how they choose the people who get those houses is that some of the people in the neighborhood will be able to vet some of these applicants before they're finally selected. So hopefully that will empower the neighborhoods to have some say about if they're getting someone who's going to remain there, or if they're just getting an investor who's going to rent that house out.
I think the first option is that Mr. Anderson, Ted Anderson, who's over that project with the city, wants it to be someone that's a homeowner and living there. Mm-hmm. But if they can't get them sold that way, or those persons don't have the money, then they are okay with having some landlords that occupy the properties. But this time, I think there'll be a better watch on who's buying them, and maintaining maybe a better database of who the landowners are, to make sure that there's not some foreclosures and the house just goes away. I mean, personally, I bought a foreclosed home in the inner city that was owned by a landlord, a guy out in California, and he was just a landlord. He didn't care. And so I guess when he got his money out of it, he didn't care. And, you know, the house, you know, it wasn't horrible or anything, but, you know, I didn't like it. But on my block alone, there's got to be 9 vacant houses.
Exactly.
And just in my 3,300 block where I live.
I was driving around yesterday and I saw dozens and dozens of blocks with so many boarded up houses. The good thing is that they are boarded up, and the thing that also gave me some encouragement was that the neighborhoods didn't look terrible. They didn't look like it's just an awful war zone out here. It looked like we can change this, but we can't let it go any further. We got to do it now if we want to make a difference and not let it go.
I think we do. We can definitely change it. Where I live is in between. I live by Central High School. I grew up by Central High School, the opposite way of where I live. The block I grew up on has no vacants. My parents are deceased, but that home has been in our family for 62 years. And I'm 48. Everyone on that block has been there for at least 48 years. So someone who grew up in a home is living in the homes for second generation blacks, because we're first generation blacks on that block. But you have to have some commitment. You have to be proud of being black, and you have to be okay with being in a community where you may be forced to only do business with other blacks. Growing up, I remember 18th and Vine being alive for a little while when I was a kid, but I also remember my mother saying that it was her hope to always put her green dollar in a black man's hand. So if that meant the black dentist, the black doctor, the black tailor, the black cleaners, the black restaurant, but we've got to be able to be committed to doing that, and then we can make our inner city areas come back to life.
You seem to have some definite solutions in your mind about how things should be done or how things can affect change in our community. Is this one of the reasons why you were able to decide to run for office?
One of the main reasons I wanted to run for office is because as a criminal defense attorney, I represent a lot of young African-American men. And too often my clients come to me without a GED or a high school diploma. And oftentimes, even if they have a high school diploma or a GED, they don't have a job, which is why they're committing some of the crimes that they commit. And I don't think I'm doing justice just by getting you the best deal. I think for me, I have to do whatever I can to make an impact, to make you a better young man. For the kids, stop hustling, stop doing the wrong thing, go to school. Because you're not going to see anybody that's making a lot of money, which is what you want to do, or having a lot of respect, that didn't go to school. I can't stress enough to finish school. I think that would be the best thing I could say.
Thank you. Thank you, Barbara. Give her a round of applause.
And so the decision to run for MCC is because for the last 15 years, I give them information about Penn Valley or the Business and Technology Center to say, hey, okay, you don't want to go to college for 4 years. I get it. But you can go down here and do this 9-month welding program. You can make more money than you was making hustling. And they didn't know about the program. They don't know. And so part of why I wanted to run is because I think that there are some jewels in that system. And two, I think those jewels need to be out in our community for people to know. There needs to be some more community engagement. I hate to see my kids, not my personal kids, but the kids in my community go to some of the proprietary schools and pay more than I paid for law school to go to a program that's going to pay you $10 an hour. And if you change your mind, you still got these loans and you're in worse financial position than before. So I thought running for this position and becoming a member of the board, we can bring Penn Valley back to greatness. And when I say Penn Valley, I do mean the entire system. I think, you know, we bring attention to the Business and Technology Center, to Longview, to Maple Woods, to Blue River, and Penn Valley itself, to the 5-campus system, so that people know that you have some jewels here. And if you're having some financial difficulties, or if educationally you may not be ready for Harvard, then let's come here and get you prepared. And then you are ready to go and get a job. You may be a skilled trade, or if you want to go on to a 4-year, we can do that too. And that education turns into you getting a better job, to you having more money, to you buying a home, to you staying in the community and giving us better economic development.
When is the election for these positions?
The election's going to be April the 5th, the same day as the Kansas City e-tax election. We're first on the ballot, and I'm the last name there. I'm the only Washington. I'm the only woman.
So when is the election for these positions?
The election is April the 5th. It's the same day as the e-tax election. April is traditionally in the Kansas City area votes for school boards and special issues. So there'll be voting in Kansas City, in Raytown, Independence, Sugar Creek, Lee Summit. All those places should have an April election vote. So April 5th is a common date for elections in Kansas City area.
It seems like that's going to be a very busy election day.
That's the anticipation.
Yeah. Now, I do want to go back to your law firm, and before we wrap things up, how did you decide you wanted to become a lawyer and open up a law firm here in Kansas City?
Well, I'm from Kansas City. I'm a lifelong native. When I was younger, I got in a little trouble. It kind of was an accident. But while I was in trouble, my parents could afford a lawyer. and I went to a juvenile facility for the summer, and I'm the only one that came out of that facility and graduated from high school. And I always attributed it to my parents could afford a lawyer. As I got older, that really wasn't it, because the lawyer was someone that I knew for my whole life. But I made a decision 35 years ago that I would become an attorney.